welcome to Geo Horton's Stage Page. Today is Sunday, the 27th of September, 2009. This time, I've selected the talk GL had with Professor Alan Woods in the airport parking lot before she entered the terminal, ready to leave Columbus to return to Boston. You can hear the planes. I've only edited out the parts where the noise totally blocked the conversation. I followed the talk with a monologue many of us can relate to. Any of us who have a 401k or IRA we hope will see us through our retirements. As always, this, and all the other monologues and mouth-offs on her site, are free for use by students or auditioning actors. And now, GL and Alan Woods.
So this is Sunday, the 23rd of August, and we're just winding up the ICWP Summer Woman Playwrights Retreat at Ohio State. There's only one major event left, that's the corn roast.
The Ohio Sweet Corn Roast.
The Ohio Sweet Corn Roast. At Professor Alan Woods' house with his gracious wife, Anne. I'm going to have to miss it, but my heart will be there.
And more's the pity. More's the pity that you're missing it, not more's the pity that your heart will be
okay.
There.
So, do you have some notable observations from this summer's event?
Well, it seemed to go very well. I mean, everyone was working very hard. And I was fascinated by some of the pieces that were emerging, both ones that people had been working on before and were tightening or coming back to, as well as the ones that were started. So, yeah, it seemed to have worked pretty well.
We seem to have taken an interesting turn away from sort of well-made realism.
Yes, there is that. Yeah. Yeah, certainly the well-made play of the two people sitting around talking and discussing their parents or their children seems to have receded a bit, which I think is probably a good thing. And I was particularly intrigued by your take on Susanna Sontleaver, who's one of my favorite forgotten playwrights.
Well, I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to have a major gossip session on your impression of Susanna, because it's very hard to find somebody to talk to about her.
Well,
when my character runs around taking the survey of is there anybody on campus who knows her work, that's pretty much my experience. And in fact, there was not one of these women playwrights who belong to a women's playwright organization and therefore are at least more curious than your average person in the street who had ever heard of her.
Which is astonishing. There is a pretty good book, which I think is, I don't know if it's still in print or not, called English Women Playwrights of the 18th Century.
I believe I have that book.
Yeah, which collects a whole bunch of people, and Susanna is in there. And I've used that book in classes. I often teach the middle chunk of the year-long survey of Western dramatic literature, which is the course some of us call privately the pits.
because the pit was a very important factor in the theater.
But it's the period after the Restoration and before realism.
Right.
So it's all the 18th century people and all the 19th century people. We call it the pits because it's all those playwrights who were very popular in their day, but who the literary mavens who have shaped what the canon is that studied the dramatic literature have ruled are not worthy of study in terms of their literature, for the most part.
Well, I find that when I actually see a staging of one of these, mm-hmm. I mean, even some of the minor ones, I remember I saw Hyde Park, and I don't even remember the author of it. But anyway, the Huntington did it, and I had a fine time. It was very interesting. It's slower, mm-hmm. much slower than we're accustomed to. So you sort of have to use the first 15 minutes slowing yourself down to the expected pace, because they kind of like to linger over the descriptions and tuck in all of the most adjectives. And I've noticed that when I'm using snippets of Sontleaver or Aphra Behn for plays within a play, for my own play, that I do quite a bit of trimming.
Quite a bit of editing, yeah. Yeah, that's true. And of course, also, once you get past the literary aspects and deal with them as popular pieces and understand that they are popular pieces or were popular pieces in their day, most of them are in fact eminently stageable. I mean, again, we have to look at them through the filter of our time, as we do with most plays.
Well, and it's fascinating. I mean, a wonderful thing. You get a three-dimensional picture of the way people interacted or expected each
yes.
other to interact,
yeah.
even if, in fact, in their private life, they didn't behave that
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
They expected that those were the impulses that people would give into if the mm-hmm. if the restraints of ordinary life were not functioning, either through manipulation or for very extreme circumstances.
Or in some cases, they... I think I was it you I was talking with about Stephen Crane's Tessa Girl of the Streets?
No.
Okay. Stephen Crane, of course, wrote The Thin Red Line.
Right.
Has a wonderful novel called Tessa Girl of the Streets. And it's about, as you would expect the title suggests, but there's a wonderful sequence in it when Tess is at a melodrama,
mm-hmm.
sobbing deeply as the heroine makes the first false step that will, in the code of melodrama, inevitably lead to her death.
Mm-hmm.
Because the code of melodrama, of course, says a woman who sins, or is even thought to have sinned, dies by the final curtain. And he makes the point that why was Tess sobbing? Because she is a girl of the street. She knows she's making money. She knows that death is not inevitable. And she knows in her, by her own life that what she's watching on stage is pure fiction. It's not true.
Well, except that in point of fact, statistically, street walking is a very dangerous profession.
To be true.
It's right up there with high iron and building railroads.
But Crane makes the point that she's sobbing because she, and he calls it transcendent realism. It's the way life should be.
That makes sense.
And that's why she's sobbing, because in streetwalkers should not have to exist and all that stuff. And I've often used that to say this is how, indeed, a lot of our, still today, our popular culture functions.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we watch these gilded people on television and films.
Well,
and
the thing that nobody seems to notice, that most of the heroes of our popular culture, from action movies to romantic comedies, are pretty much psychopathic.
Yes.
I mean, these terrible things, they do them, they happen to them, and yet they are unaffected. They are the same
mm-hmm.
character.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's necessary for series television,
that's
because
true.
you can't tune in a month later and discover that your hero has just totally fallen apart.
But, or that he's repented and joined a Zen monastery in Northern California.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So that's part of it. But still, it was very exciting watching the work develop over the week, as it always is. We had, I think, a total of 15 playwrights here, if we count up all the people, some day trippers.
Yes, there was a noticeable sort of queue for readings.
Mm-hmm.
There were many more people, and they were more productive, so you had to kind of wait your turn
yeah.
in more than
yeah.
you have had in the past. The thing that really astonished me was that this time we had actors, bless their hearts, who came and were mm-hmm. as magnificently helpful as they always are, but we had a handful of fans,
yes.
people who came just because they found the process fascinating
yeah.
and wanted to hear these things as they were being created. And I can't tell you what a thrill that was, because I find most people find both playwrights and their process pretty darn boring.
Well, it's a very solitary process, isn't it? Even though it's group creation in the sense that you have to have actors and a director and all the rest.
And the collaborators will take it over and make a lot of it their own.
Yes.
So you'll say, what
yeah.
is that? Did I do that? But still, most of it is spent sitting in front of a computer screen mm-hmm. in a lonely room and hoping that the phone doesn't ring.
Yeah.
But we had people who came, we had somebody who came every single
Yes.
to every single night's
yeah.
readings
yeah.
and just listened and laughed and applauded.
And the astonishing thing about Therese Nolan, that woman who was there every night.
Yeah, but she was performing, so
yeah.
that made sense. You know, that I could see how somebody would want to come, because I do it.
Well,
it's how I got hooked on this process.
I
came as an actress and
yeah.
just loved reading people's new work.
I say, part of the astonishing thing about that is Therese accompanies our critic for the Columbus Dispatch to all the opening nights, or all the previews. I mean, she sees everything in town, or almost everything in town, literally, because she is his accompaniment and goes with him when he reviews things. So I'm surprised.
Busman's holiday.
Yeah, I'm surprised, after, and she's been doing this for about 15 years. So I'm surprised she hasn't burnt out and doesn't want to just settle down with a good Harlequin romance and forget all this theatrical stuff. So but you're right, and there were a couple of people who came just to listen. That too was interesting. And of course we have a couple of people who've done this several times before as actors and who look forward to it and who contact me every spring and say, are the playwrights coming again and when? So which is terrific. Well, where are we at?
Well, it's 7 o'clock in the morning and I've run out of ideas, but that doesn't mean that you have.
Well, the whole process, of course, of play development, and you know, and often I see people writing on the ICWP listserv about sort of development play reading hell, when your play gets into the endless loop of getting lots of staged readings and never apparently a full production, and getting all kinds of readings hither and yon. I hope we don't contribute to that in some way.
Well, I haven't really had that experience. I don't send out that much. Mm-hmm. Because I have the feedback of putting my plays up on my website, and people do them. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't get anything out of people doing them because I don't get to see it. Mm-hmm. But I do, my own writers group produces. So I do see my work in my own hometown, and I see my work, and I know that my work is being done, so I don't really pursue that thing where you hope to get a reading and you fly to it and your heart is all up and you think they're going to produce it and they make all changes, they suggest changes and you make the changes and they say, oh, that's a lot, that's really, it's good work you've done there. I'm afraid, though, it doesn't fit into our season, and then next year they say, or in this season, or in, the, you know,
or
which
any,
is...
any season.
Right, which is what people say, because I recently went to a wonderful series of readings by, and they were... The majority of them were women, and then I congratulated them afterwards. Said, "This is so wonderful that you know they're thinking of producing you." And they all rolled their eyes and said, "No, this is what they do instead of producing you. When they give you a really good reading, you know you're probably done."
Do you want to talk at all about the various things that keep coming up about this very small number of women playwrights who are actually being produced in terms of the larger scheme of things?
Well, I don't know what to say about it except that, you know, I constantly nag about that. Mm-hmm. There is a meeting coming up on Tuesday in New York, which I didn't reserve for, but I might actually get on the bus and go down and try to do standing room or something. I'll see if I'll contact them when I get home. I don't know what can be done, except that if the key finding, which was that if you do produce a woman, she will do as well financially and critically as the men do, which is the big fear that, you know, they say, well, I, you know, there's some work by women I really like and I would produce it, but I don't dare take the chance because it risks my theater because critics don't praise and audiences don't appreciate women playwrights, which seems not to be statistically the case, although those statistics are probably over-optimistic because it is so much harder for a woman's playwright to get work to get done. The ones who get done are probably just very, 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 very good. Because on the reading level, I see as many bad plays by women as by men.
But, and certainly I would say with the Eileen Heckert Drama for Seniors competition that I run every other year and I'm in the final throes of now as we speak, the number of bad plays is not gender specific.
Yeah, but
nor is the number of good plays.
But it was kind of scary because this year the Mass Cultural Councils, they give out fellowships every year. I think they give three winners and a number of runners up, and it's a substantial sum of money, and it probably looks good on the resume. And this year, for the first time that I remember seeing, there were no women among the winners. And I think only one among the runners-up. And that was very disturbing to me, because this is one of the contests that doesn't cost anything to enter. It does, you have to actually print out three copies, but you don't put in the whole play. It's three copies of like 30 pages. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's five copies of 30 pages. Whatever it is, it's still nowhere near the investment that some of these contests are. So I assume that everyone I know is entering. And yet there was no one I knew on the list, and only one woman's name. So I don't know whether the women have just gotten discouraged from submitting to this thing, or whether this particular year was just some kind of a mathematical fluke, but I will certainly be...
Whether there were a couple of misogynist judges on
Or whether there were a couple of misogynist judges, because in theory it's all red blind and they don't know. You know, it's not an honor for which you need... I was asking one of my talented friends whether she had submitted her play, which I had heard a reading of, and was wonderful. And she said, oh, no, I don't bother with such things because I can't, you know, I've been out of school for 35 years. I can't, you know, get a letter of recommendation from some important playwriting program or producer. I'm not connected to any name theater, and I just can't face the effort of trying. Mm. And I said, no, no, this one you don't have to do anything but send them in 30 pages of your script and they read it blind, which is unusual. But maybe that, you know, the amount of red tape that's associated with most of these contests has rubbed off on one that isn't guilty of it.
And also, of course, once again, as we were saying earlier or at some point, lots of people don't read instructions. And, you know, just, and well, as somebody was saying, and one of our, I guess one of our, maybe one of our theater people who came in and talked to the group over the week said something about they get lots of scripts that clearly their company doesn't do that kind of script.
And yeah,
they
well.
They have to sift through mountains of material that people just send helter-skelter out.
Well, apparently the kind of plays that playwrights write to get produced are not really the kind of plays that they would write left to themselves, because mm-hmm. all the playwrights I know have drawers full of plays that have more than the 2 to 5 characters which are presently acceptable.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I looked at that wonderful theater's list of plays that they've done, mm-hmm. and their plays this year have 2 to 5 characters.
Yep. Yep.
And they're doing a couple of one-person shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just not interested in writing those.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that my latest one, I'm trying to have, you know, 17 characters with 6 actors. But really, I'd sort of like to have 30 characters with 15
well,
actors.
Is there still, it used to be, back when I was paying more attention to this sort of thing, it used to be there was a demand from, like, high schools and colleges and community theaters for large cast plays.
There still is, but you can't get published unless you've been produced in New York, and you can't get produced in New York if your play calls for a cast bigger than the theater will support equity members' salaries for.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, there really is a crunch there.
So there's a
catch
22,
and what do
yeah.
they do? They do the plays from England,
mm-hmm.
where they have supported publicly supported theater, and it really works. It is, because the rest of the world doesn't have this small, professionalized, super unionized theater.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They have mixed amateur and professional, and they need plays, and they're happy to do plays with
mm-hmm.
big casts.
Mm-hmm.
So the English crank them out, and they nurture them through the development process, and they stage them in London. I mean, I've seen big cast plays in London with the best actors in the world in them, in which the cast almost outnumbered the audience,
mm-hmm.
and they were pretty good plays, not
mm-hmm.
great plays, but that's the process.
Let
a thousand flowers bloom, and then the ones that are worth keeping,
mm-hmm.
you bundle up and export to the world, and then you are the exciting source of world drama.
Yeah, and there's a breathless piece in the New York Times this morning about to happen transfer of Jude Law's Hamlet from London to Broadway.
And you think,
and it's all
if
about,
they can afford, you know, for the cost of one Hamlet, they could do,
yeah.
you know, 15 new playwrights.
But it's all about how the producer of the Donmar Warehouse in London has an exclusive arrangement with a Broadway producer who gets first look at all their production for potential transfer. And when they were planning to do, even before they announced it in London, they called her and said, do you want to come look at it? And what do you think? And she came to London and liked it and thought it has commercial possibilities. So it's transferring, and we'll be there opening, I guess, this week or next week in New York. And you know, Jude Law is a wonderful actor. But as you say, for transporting an entire company from London, between that and the coming up Broadway season of the collected works of Neil Simon, whole batches of new plays.
Are they really going to do Neil Simon on Broadway?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, they're doing two, and maybe they're going to add the third of the autobiographical plays.
Oh.
Broadway bound.
Well, yeah, except for the autobiographical plays, I haven't seen a Neil Simon in 20 years.
Yeah, no,
and
no, no,
I go to a lot of plays, because it's only lately I was a critic for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then I passed my critical position to my friend Will Stackman. And before he died, I was his go-with.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a lot of plays.
Yes, well, Neil is back. I guess he's moving into the classic status.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't surprise me, because
no.
his plays are, in fact, very well-crafted for that kind, for their period in time. And we're now far enough in time away from that they, I think, have reached the stage, as all plays do, of, you know, as conventions shift and change, plays become old-fashioned, and no one does them. Then another 10 years, and they become classic.
Well, because the things that no longer make sense anymore, the things that you realize are peculiar to the illusions of that period, what we think we're doing, not what we're actually doing, jump out at you in the way that is not just something you dismiss, it's something that becomes interesting. Oh, my parents acted that way because, now I understand why they talk to me like they do. Which, at the time, it was the young person's story who was revealing what was wrong with their parents.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, you can see how their reaction to their parents affected how they treated you.
Well, the example I always give to my students at Ohio State, because they, of course, are young, and anything that's older than about 5 years is hopelessly old-fashioned. I say, well, if you look at the well-made realistic play of the 20th century, almost all of them are rooted in Freudian psychology. So they all have the structure of classical Freudian analysis.
Mm-hmm.
There's a flaw, there's a hidden event.
And talking about it fixes it.
And once you uncover the hidden event, whether it's Willie Loman giving the stockings to the lady in Boston, or Brick and Skipper in Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, but once you uncover it, then it's solved, or it can be solved, and you can move on past it. And once you know that's the structure, then you can see what's going on. And for a while there, in the 70s and 80s, that Freudian structure was just hopelessly old-fashioned. And so no one bothered with it, because they said, what? Oh, come on. And then starting in the early 90s, suddenly that became period.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, that's how my parents, that explains my parents. So suddenly William Inge and Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller all began to be revived and treated as classics. And you overlook those kind of funky things about the edges, just as we overlook the kind of funky things in Shakespeare. You know, they say, oh, come on. Just because he assassinates the king doesn't mean the whole world dissolves into chaos.
Well, it's interesting because putting my plays on my website, I noticed that there doesn't seem to be any preference between the plays that I think of as modern and more imaginatively done and my oldest creaky ones. The kids like them about equally. Uh-huh. You know, they've sort of randomly picked from the various periods in which I've written these short plays that I put out there. So that's interesting. You can kind of be contemporary, old-fashioned, and classic within a single lifetime.
Well, yes, indeed, a lot of people have. Much to their, in some cases, astonishment and joy or dismay. As it goes on. How does that work with the things online? Do you get royalties from those people? Or sometimes?
The pieces that are short and basically for students, I don't bother with. I don't feel that I could ask enough to make worth bothering them. Because it's a bother. You know, you have to fill out envelopes and put stamps on it, and banks now charge you for things. So especially people who do it outside the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they... My bank would want more for giving me the money than it's worth.
Yeah.
But if I do have contracts for commercial productions, and the few for commercial productions that come up, and sometimes they actually get fulfilled and people pay me for them. But mostly they're done by kids, and they're done as their own directing or acting project. And ordinarily they would probably just go to the library and get something out of there, because they're not really publicly performing it. They're doing it for their class, or for their class and their parents, or whatever. Now, the Canadians are much better about these things. They expect to pay, because that's in their education budget. So they say, if you do a play for the three senior classes, and that's all who comes, nevertheless, the playwright's going to get their little... So I'm always happy when some Canadian school does my work. But I know that American high schools, there's nobody's budget. It either comes out of the kids' pocket or...
And also, of course, many of them are, as we've all discovered to our horror, ignorant of the copyright laws in many cases, or the responsibilities. You know, we all heard the stories or suffered the stories of teachers who just cut willy-nilly and read and change things around.
Well, I know that I started writing plays before I had any idea that somebody else had written the material that I was making my plays out of. You know, I was a kid, and you read a good story, you see a good story, and you get your friends together, and you go out in the garage, and you put it on.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of that impulse out there, too, and certainly I don't want to squelch it.
That's true. There's a certain point at which I do constantly remind my students that there are copyright laws, and that They can't just take things willy-nilly, even though they find them online or wherever.
I do get nice little letters asking for permission.
That's good.
Yes.
That's good.
And I got one while I was here yesterday, and I said, I can't give you my official permission form until I get home to my home computer, but take this as a yes.
Well, that's terrific. I'm glad that the web connections are still working even when you're away from Boston. Which, of course, is the point of the web.
I just hope all the electronic connections I made while I was here, you know, I'm very nervous until the plane gets back and I can take my thumb drive and put it into my home computer and see that all the work I did actually shows up on my home screen and will print on my home printer.
Well, that's always the danger, isn't it? It's the compatibility of the systems, which is always suspect.
Yeah. We spent a lot of time in the lab running around asking each other how to do this on the particular machine we're working on. Has anybody done this with this program before? You know how to... It doesn't seem to want my password. Did it take yours?
Yeah, it's because we're also dependent on these. It's a far cry from the days when you packed up your little portable typewriter, or I don't know if you ever did that. I certainly did. I had a little manual portable typewriter that I carried with me when I was doing that sort of thing.
I tried, but if the computer hadn't been invented, I would never be a playwright, because I can't type three words without making it a typo. Fortunately, the computer recognizes them right away. I fix them with no problem, and on we go.
Yeah.
I think we've run out.
I think we have. Okay.
Shortly after that was recorded, GL did enter the terminal, did board the plane, did arrive at Logan, and did return to her waiting family in Newton. And now for my monologue from the Mothoff section of her website about the abuses heaped upon us mere mortals by those in a position to manipulate the market. Feel free to go to the Mothoff section of www.stagepage.info for the text to this monologue. All my money has suddenly gone down a sinkhole. It was there yesterday. It's not here today. It just vanished. Was it ever real? Ever? I thought I knew what money is, how it represents products and labor, and so it can be exchanged. People all agreed that money can be earned, saved, invested, inherited, spent, wasted, stolen, but vanished? I don't understand. So I'm looking for someone to blame. There are plenty of places to look. Plenty of people who have been unmasked as crooks and liars. Rage and shock and tears and nausea pour through me in waves as it all unravels. But didn't we have an agreement about keeping faith with each other? When the regulators, the CEOs, the realtors, the loan officers, and yes, those borrowers who had a suspicion that the loan they were offered might be more than they could repay. When all these people decided to grab as much as they could and the hell with everyone else. Is that what caused the rip in the fourth dimension to open up, to swallow all my savings? Along with all of our hopes for the future. And there you have it. I do hope you enjoyed the talk. A bit long, but definitely worth it. And where would I break it? Or what could I cut? No. If you're a theater person, you wanted every word. Also, try to remember to visit www.stagepage.info and check out the new or the older short pieces, free for use by students and auditioning actors. This production is the creation and property of David Meyer in association with G.L. Horton and the www.stagepage.info website. It may be redistributed in whole or in part only with credit given and notice sent to davidmeyer@me.com. Our music is from the Free Play Music Library, license granted through Apple's .Mac program.